generating bodhicitta. May all sentient beings, samsara, be free from suffering, be joyful and truly abide in supreme happiness. Create the supreme mind and impartial to our all, in order to attain the heart of awakening. In order that we may fully benefit the beings of the six realms, we must attain the stage of Buddhahood in this very lifetime. Therefore, be very diligent in this unsurpassed teaching, the path luminously clear, Vajra essence. May all sentient beings, samsara, be free from suffering, be joyful and truly abide in supreme happiness. We create the supreme mind, impartial towards all, in order to attain the heart of awakening. In order that we may fully benefit the beings of six realms, we must attain the stage of Buddhahood in this very lifetime. Therefore, be very diligent in this unsurpassed teaching, the path luminously clear, Vajra essence. Gorwe samchen dugna dragna shing dewa chogla gampa nila ga kunla tangyum nyampe samchodi janshu nimpo tochu dagi ki dagi drodru samchen kundon chu sange gopang situ topaja dichu usso dorje nimpo lam lamme chodru rabbe sampa. And before I open up the floor to some questions, I'd like to start with questions this morning. I want to read two pages out of 356 verses of praises and contemplations of Bodhicitta. It's the most remarkable text, a text written in 1959 by a very, very famous lama, Kunu Lama. And he has a remarkable story. But he wrote three, he was asked to do this. Would you write a contemplation or a praise on bodhicitta every day? So he did. And this is a remarkable text of 356 verses. So I'm going to read a few because they're so profound. It's actually the way I like to start every class. I'm going to start with 290. I just opened it this morning and went, oh, that's lovely. 290. Bodhicitta is the sun that clears away the great darkness of belief in a self, a belief in a real self. Going from light to light, in dependence on it, they are totally good. With bodhicitta, one drives out feelings of pain. With bodhicitta, one overcomes nastiness. With bodhicitta, one cures unhappiness. With bodhicitta, one gets rid of fear. Even for the supreme sage, that's referring to Buddha Shakyamuni, it was difficult to please every living being. But if one comes to have bodhicitta, almost everyone will come to be pleased. If one really does have a mind to be a Mahayanist, that is the great vehicle of Dharma, then one should produce the bodhicitta that has not been produced and never let what has been produced degenerate. In general, a virtuous thought arises only with difficulty. Even more difficult than that is the beginning of the Buddhist path. Yet even more difficult is the arising of precious bodhicitta. Nevertheless, one generates it by making an effort. Mahayana bodhicitta arises from long and continued meditation on affection for whom one loves, and compassion and so on, just as a seedling arises when all of its causes are brought together. If one is in possession of bodhicitta, it is fine if one is sick, fine if one is dying, fine if one is studying, fine if one is meditating. One seems to be fine no matter what one is doing. If one has become habituated to this bodhicitta, what wrong would one not have abandoned? What good would one not have done? Enthusiastically strive to meditate upon it. If one is without the vital juice of bodhicitta, one cannot even enter the great vehicle. If such is the case, how will one get to the supreme stage of Buddhahood? It is hard for bodhicitta to arise in a mind stream ever disturbed by afflictive emotions, just as it is hard for a 100-petal lotus to arise in a place with no marshlands. When a foundation of bodhicitta has been laid down, terrible wrongdoing is naturally stopped. All wholesome activity comes into one's hands. One is free from anxiety and panic and comes to be stable. The life of a person who has not taken up bodhicitta is without purpose. And actually, that's, I would put in there, without great purpose, without profoundly deep purpose. Like the hope of reaping a harvest without having planted a seed in the ground. So you see from these verses, so much is about causality. And the metaphor that's often used is planting seeds to have fruit trees or a crop grow. If one does not have a fertile soil, one does not prepare the ground in a advantageous manner, then the liberative mind, which is always present, can't grow. This is the key. So when I say yesterday that causality is the first major wisdom to be established, it is like fertilizing a field, having all the right conditions for the seedling of bodhicitta to grow. Otherwise, what keeps happening is the arising of bodhicitta keeps getting diminished, keeps getting stunted. Not enough water, not enough nutrients, a little bit too little potassium, too little nitrogen, the leaves don't look very good, viruses come in. You see? You get the idea? So this is why the training is essential, and also why we need good mentors and tradition to help us see what are the fertile conditions. So I wanted just to mention that this morning. And then I'd like to see if you have any questions before I carry on with this. Yes?
How do you see the deep root? You mentioned yesterday about the tree that that we don't see the vision, you know, and then we keep trimming the leaves and the branches, but we don't see the root, the real root. I tried yesterday.
Yeah, how'd you do?
I know, I couldn't.
You're looking right at it.
Well, I was trying to see what was the root, you know, and I made a lot of effort, but
yeah, good. And it's going to take effort and building strength and capacity, and then it will dawn. It has to dawn because that's the way the mind is. See, this is where confidence comes in. The mind is already stainless. It just have to have the right conditions to let it. It will pop out. It'll pop out. And if you don't have the teaching, you won't know what popped out. Some people actually have it pop out and they don't know what it is. They just go, oh, calm mind, or that was nice. So this the root of all states is a confusion about the nature of mind. But where we start is we have to realize here's something I haven't really talked about. I've talked about it a few times other places. If you consider how many moments in the day there is self-referencing, have you ever counted? You don't want to. I guarantee you don't want to. But if you count how many moments of self-referencing where the mind goes to go, how am I doing? How am I in relationship to them? Do they love me? You know, and so on. All the dialogues, the internal dialogues, there's somewhere between 15 and 30,000 a day. That's the major force of conditioning. That self-referencing constantly creates an illusion of a solid ego that has to be defended, protected, bolstered. But mixed in there, inseparably mixed in there, is this pristine nature?
There's no tree.
No, there never was a tree. So here is the dilemma. I feel this is a good metaphor. You grow up with this tree slowly growing. Mm-hmm. And you know how things grow very slowly, you don't notice them? They're just like part of your nature. And all of a sudden, one day, the entire view through the window is obscured, but the view becomes the tree. And the tree is the afflictive states that you're used to. I used to give a metaphor which was absurd. I used to like it. I don't know where it came from. Maybe Alice in Wonderland, but I used to give this analogy or metaphor. Imagine if there was a hole in the ground in your garden and you stuck your hand down in the hole and you couldn't pull it back up. So you're now lying on the ground with your hand down here and your hand is stuck in the hole. Right? Maybe you're going and reaching for potatoes or truffles. You think you're a dog or a pig and reaching for truffles. And your arm gets caught. What happens? Well, the first day it's pretty much a struggle, isn't it? The second day it's pretty difficult. And people come by you and think you're just lying on the ground, so they give you food every once in a while and water. Is that nice? What do you think would happen after a month or 2 months? You begin to get used to it. And that's your life. Your life is stuck with your arm down a hole, and people come by and look at you and go, here, have some water, have some food. And then it becomes very, very difficult for someone to come along and say, you can take your arm out. Very difficult, because you're used to the affliction of the arm stuck in a hole. That's the way it is. Now that's a metaphor I used to give, but it's kind of weird. So the new one I've come up with is the tree growing over the window. I think that's. But although I think the first one is more about really the way it is. I have to keep these things myself. But anyways, there's many old-fashioned analogies, but that's one I come up with. So it is also like a car that's malfunctioning. The engine malfunctions, valve isn't working, and you get used to it. And it heaves out oil, but it becomes so normal, that's the sound of the car, that's the way the car is working, and you just keep driving it and people get used to it, you get used to it. But in fact, it's not actually functioning well. Do you follow? So we get used to these things. In fact, we have to be introduced to another possibility. So neuropsychologists have found through research that it takes about 12 to 13 years for a child to become conditioned to actually cognitively experience the world the way we do as adults. They don't. Children do not experience the world the way we do, but it takes about 12 or 13 years before they're socialized and conditioned into being functioning, being able to be an adult. So it's too slow. So now when we function, this is why we have retreats. And I'm not a retreat salesman, but I might sound like it. Because every single yogin, that's a male and female high practitioner, every single male and female yogin from the Buddha's time onward, even the Buddha has had to do profound retreats to come to have confidence, even if there's a glimpse. One still needs to retreats to have confidence and stability in the stainless, pure bodhicitta. So I'm going to come back to this statement again. And I'm being friendly. Don't think I'm being nasty. I'm being friendly. We don't know how much our lives are in a blur of cognitive blur. Until we settle down profoundly. We take out all the inputs. You know what it's like in a retreat to take away a cell phone from people? They won't. People today will not give up their cell phone. They'll have two. They'll give one away and they'll keep another one. When you put someone in an MRI and you look at the pathways that light up for a cell phone, it's the same as cocaine addiction. I love cell phones, by the way. They're marvelous. Yes? But all the inputs that we have are very fast moments. You can't produce a film anymore, unless it's an experimental film, that has a scene longer than half a second. Remember The Matrix? Scene changes about every half a second. I remember 30 years ago, and I'm not promoting this, I'm just saying 30 years ago, being up in the Canadian Arctic watching the Inuit Broadcasting Corporation making movies. They'd have the same scene for 5 minutes. You're watching a dog sled go by for 5 minutes, and there's only this in the background. Maybe that's George. And there's just white snow. But for them, that was, you know, their life, 10 minutes watching. And that was Inuit Broadcasting. That was on television. The amount of multitasking, the blur of cognition, is never been higher. And it's getting faster and faster and faster and faster and faster. To go into retreat, which means retreat from the busyness, you get to see cognition. You get to see your states, your body, in a way that the views, the bought knowledge starts to fall away. You get to see it as it is. It takes time. So it takes time to unbind the body sensations. It takes time to unbind the feeling energies. It takes time to unbind the states of mind and let them fall. It's all bound. It's all tight. Just like this. Most people have a grip on their belly and another part of their body too, which is close to their belly, but behind. And it's like this. And it takes about 3 months. If you start working on it today and let your belly out, keep letting it out, keep letting it out, it takes about 3 months before it will pop out. It just lets go. Now, some of you are not going to want to do that because you're going to say, well, I won't look very good, but you'll feel a lot better. When this is happy and warm and open, your whole being glows. Yeah? And your mind will not settle, I guarantee your mind will not settle naturally, effortlessly, until this opens. It won't, it can't. It just won't happen. To have a sustained, non-conceptual, non-thought state, this has to actually fall open. It just has to relax. So it takes time to unbind. And it's not your fault. Nobody did this to you. It is the nature of how we condition beings so they can actually be social creatures and function. But it's not liberation. So the art is to do both. It's called the two-in-one teaching. It's very difficult to teach and train in. The two-in-one teaching, the relative and the absolute at the same moment. You can have thoughts, but you see thoughts as rainbows. You can have feelings, but you know the nature of feelings. You're not fooled. You can have a self, but you know that no self actually truly exists. It's a figment. It's a production. And yet you need to have a healthy self. But referencing the self and defending the self and bolstering the self kills. And sometimes it actually kills. Right? Look around the world, you'll see the evidence of it. It's really serious. So we start with causality. And I'm going to give you today a practice, a very old ancient practice, high practice, from the Abhidhamma tradition, of how you actually study causality and train in what's called recollective mindfulness, not one-pointedness, the ability to untangle the conditioning. So we only need, to start with, we only need three reference points, conceptual reference points, really easy. You can write it down, but I think you can maybe remember it. Three words: greed, hatred, and delusion. That's it. By the way, Buddhism doesn't like complicated stuff. There's whole volumes written on things. But actually, the lower the number of things that you need to contemplate, the better. So greed, hatred, and delusion are called the three roots. Delusion is the root. Greed and hatred are subroots. you can take every single afflictive emotion and put it under the category of greed, hatred, delusion. Sadness, happiness, everything, just under it. There are three opposite roots. The three unwholesome roots are greed, hatred, delusion. The three opposites from greed is generosity. From hatred is loving kindness. And from delusion is wisdom. So if every single state of mind, every moment of mind is one of those six roots, then we can actually begin to observe all of our speech and all of our body activity based on mental intent. That sounds simple, doesn't it? But not only do we have the states arising, but we have the influences of the outer environment. We have a container and the contained. So, for instance, what you ate today, what you drank today, what you had last week, influences your mind states. The place where you're in influences your mind states. But the primary mover is the conditioning of the mind states. And when we practice this very high insight meditation for a causality, we need to only break it down into greed, hatred, delusion, and generosity, a loving kindness, and wisdom. So how do you do that? You take a step and you look at the mind and you see the mind before the step and you ask, which root is it? And you catch it. This is classic practice. And you see where it's coming from and you see if you can move the state. So for instance, let's say you take a book. It's as simple as this. Take a book, we're reading it, we're looking at it, and we go like this. Most of the time we don't notice that we've done that. We don't. See, people don't. Greed, hatred, delusion, which one?
Hatred.
Hmm? Hatred. Probably hatred, but you have to know. You have to know. Probably irritability, but it might be delusion. But you have to catch the mental state behind the activity. This is not by chance.
Could you explain delusion?
Delusion is not knowing. Delusion okay. is stupidity, yeah. Stupidity, dullness, and just not knowing the nature of states mm-hmm. or causality. Greed is attachment, stickiness, lust, must have, want, and hatred is anything from anger, rage, irritability, frustration.
Is delusion more difficult to put your finger on, to identify?
Absolutely. Deluded beings have a hard time with delusion. Really hard. And actually, the hardest people to teach are deluded beings. We almost always like angry types. Really greedy or really angry, then you can work with something. But deluded is very, very difficult. Very difficult. Give me an angry type. Then we can really, you know, no, I'm just kidding.
Is it true that delusion feeds into hatred and greed? Is it sort of like a doorway, possibly, into hatred and greed?
The root is delusion. The root is this blindness of not seeing what mind is. Yeah? This isn't fun. You know, this is, to me, it's fun. I've always found, since I started studying Dharma, this is amazingly beautiful and interesting. Some people find it disconcerting. You mean I don't know what my mind is? That's right. Do you mean I don't know mind's nature? That's right. Because when you're told you know what your mind is, mind, right? Don't we all have mind? Don't we all have awareness? But if I ask you, what is your awareness? You go, well, I know what it is. And that's the tree that grew up in front of the window. But wait a minute. Doesn't everybody know what mind is? No, if you do know what mind is, you'll get a Nobel Prize, guaranteed. Right? There's a lot of people actively working on that because they want that Nobel Prize. It really is. You'll feel this in meditation. In somewhere you'll feel it many times. It literally feels like you've got veils. And once you start to feel those veils in front of your cognition, you'll start to know. You'll just start to go, I want to get through those veils. And the most difficult veil, you're going to find this unbelievable. This is the case. The most difficult veil you're going to have to deal with is the veil of tranquility. All of us want to be tranquil and happy. And that, in the end, becomes the most difficult veil to get through. Comfort. We have to start with tranquility, but then we're going to have to bust through tranquility. Literally a veil. It's like, you know when... You know this feeling? Watch. Just watch this feeling. Doesn't that feel good? That blissful feeling of just... Yeah? It's really good, but it doesn't go anywhere. So, this figure of Manjusri is very peaceful. He's sweet and peaceful. He's 16 years old. In his left hand, he has a lotus, which represents wisdom, and the book is the Prajnaparamita, Teachings of Wisdom. But in the right hand is a sword. It's slicing through delusion. You have to have both. You need a sword to bust through the obstacles of the views that you can't see, and you need the wisdom teachings to unfold that. Fifth instructions.
So, Mark, from a meditation or experiential point of view, then you literally arrive at a point where, like the veils that you mentioned, you can begin to identify, this could be delusion, this could be anger, which right. seem to be maybe more obvious. That so you actually are able to begin to label them a little bit, and then labeling moves them.
Yeah, labeling them in the simplest way you can without a complex story or dialogue. So, this beautiful, precious book, irritability. That's all you need. You don't need to know where the irritability came from. You don't need to know who did it to you. You don't need to know which parent. You don't need to know which relative. You don't need to know whether it was from your Hungarian ancestors. You don't even need to know if it's past lives. You simply need to identify the state. And then what do you do? Watch how you change karmic formations. You keep doing it until you feel loving kindness. You keep doing it until you feel generosity and you know that state. It's no different than golf. When you hit that precisely perfect shot, you hear the sound and it is magnificent. Archery, sewing, knitting, needlework, painting, surgery, right? Same thing. It's free of greed, hatred, delusion. You can feel it. You'll know it. You go, oh my God, that's magnificent. That's what abbots are for in monasteries. Stop running. Wear your robe right. Don't eat with your mouth open. The monastic training is for monks is 250 different subtle trainings of conduct to straighten out that kind of mindfulness so that the greed it's leveled out. For nuns it's 300. And actually it's not because women are bad. if you study the history of the precepts in the Buddhist precepts, it's because women had to be protected. That's why. Societally protected. So they have more precepts. No, it's true. Actually true. It's not because they're sinful in any way. So this is a practice. It's a study. And you have to slow down so much that you can actually see those states forming the body and the speech. You know, you've had that experience, eh? The foot in the mouth? Why did I say that? Why did I do that for the millionth time of my life? Those are called karmic patterns, and they build a life. Why did I steal that? Why did I take that without permission? I didn't need it. Why the irritability? Oh, because of. There's a story. Why the frustration? There's always a story. But actually, the mind isn't frustrated. The states are frustrated. The history, the stories are frustrated. The entire path, if I can summarize it, the entire path of liberation is unbinding what is bound. And the fastest path would literally be, if you could do it, is sit here like this, and every time there is a bound state, you let it unbind. And you will twitch, and you'll have pains and irritability, and you'll cry, and you'll want to leave, and you'll want to get up, and you'll want to move, and you'll just go, ah! And then there'll be periods of, oh my God, this feels so good, and over, and just the system unbinds, unbinds, unbinds. And then eventually, as we practice in Mahamudra and Dzogchen, we have to get rid of the activity of unbinding. That becomes even more difficult. You have to receive the instructions for that and really know how to do that. You have to let go of any attempt to unbind. But the organism wants to unbind. We used to do it as children. What was it called as children? Tenter tantrums. We're not allowed to do it anymore. Most of you in the room at some point after a 3-hour class will go, get me out of here! I don't want to be here anymore. But as adults, we're trained not to do that. But most adults are having tender tantrums all day long. But they get suppressed and they get pushed down. And they explode every once in a while. Is that right? They explode. So when they use the word asawa in Pali, idante punyakamang asawaki wahangho tu, that word asawa means flood, literally flood or cancer. And every once in a while, when we get too bound up, the flood explodes, just like a mudslide or a volcano like fuego going. And we explode. We explode with greed, hatred, delusion. That is the path of antidote, but it's a very, very clear path. Is you keep unbinding what's bound and finding the pockets of freedom. The more you get comfortable with wholesomeness and freedom, what's called virtue or ethics, then you can reside, the mind will reside in a very pure state. Eventually, you'll discover the nature of that pure state. It's nothing that is conceptually bound. It has no fixation. So another way of saying this for Mahamudra, for Dzogchen, for Bodhicitta, is the whole path is to come to non-construction, non-fixation of a self-referencing being until it can actually handle remaining in an uncontrived state. That doesn't mean you can't have concepts. Okay? So it takes time. You have to let the organism unbind. Yes?
Where is fear in the roots?
There isn't any.
No, but if you feel fear, how you identify?
Oh,
in
the three roots.
In the three
roots. Fear is anger.
It's anger?
Yeah, whenever you have fear, you push away something. Okay, it's anxiety. Most of what we experience is not fear. Most of what we experience today is anxiety. Fear is a physiological response to get the organism out of the way. Leopard jumps in your Jeep on safari, you will have fear. That's a good response. Yeah. Car is coming at you down the road and the adrenaline surges and you jump out of the way. Right? That's fear. That's fear. Anxiety is not knowing where the threat is. There's a story about it, and there might not even be a story about it. But pervasive anxiety, when it comes, is what most people call fear. Yeah? But it's actually not. although the two are physiologically are bound very much like that. So when we experience fear, we actually push away the threat. Yeah? It's called in Pali, instead of dosa, which is anger, in Pali, the word is used for the refinement of anger is called patiga. And it's actually a beautiful word. It means to push away. So you'll see that when there is fear and anger, the system closes down, right? Defends itself. And then when it gets angry, it pushes away. Explodes, pushes away, or runs.
So it's hatred.
It's hatred.
Wow. That's
fuego. Just looking at your mind. These are good. I like your question. Anybody else? I'll just see if anybody else has a question first. Yes.
Yeah, but then the fear of death would be delusion, no?
Fear of death is illusion. Nothing is dying. We have lots of challenges in life. They're called bardos. Intermediate states. One is death. One is waking up. One is falling asleep. There's the bardo of sleep. There's the bardo of dreams. There's the bardo of orgasm. There's the bardo of all kinds of intermediate states where we lose our awareness. But the continuum of pristine awareness doesn't actually die in any state. So there are beings who can actually die consciously because they're so in union with pristine awareness. And even though the self experience changes, the pristine awareness doesn't. So here's a question for you. What is the actual real nature of yourself? That's really what it is. If you really examine self, you will see, and this is not negative, it's actually beautiful, you will see that all the self-reflections, the experience of self, are temporary, momentary, fleeting sensory experiences. It takes time to get used to that. No one in the Dharma is trying to kill off the self. There's nothing wrong with the self. It's the belief that the self is actually a real entity that has to be built, protected, defended against, constantly self-referenced to others, is the real a killer. Then further, we have a further one for full liberation. If you want to go beyond self-liberation, full liberation is knowing the nature of all phenomenal experience. It's the same emptiness. It's luminous, it's bright, it's compassionate, and the self nature is like a rainbow. It's like the moon reflected in water. But it sure feels real when it gets poked. Isn't that right? Doesn't it feel solid and real? If I ever said to you, can you imagine someone as idiotic as saying, your emotions are illusory? No way, I've been told they're real. Take a look. It's really easy to do. Take a look right now. Let's do a meditation right now. Bring up any one of the roots, any one of the three roots. Greed, hatred, delusion, just dredge it up. Throw it right up there. And then look at it in this room with your eyes straight open, slightly elevated, and just sit back and look at it and ask, and actually look at it and see what it is. So bring it up. I am utterly irritable. And then you tell me what it is. Where is it? If you did that for a month or 3 months, you'd poke right through. Because it can't be sustained. The illusion can't be sustained. But if you don't have the training and the foundation, then you will never do it. So Because one doesn't do things unless one trusts it. How many people have gone to university here? Wow, okay. How many people paid to go to university? Why did you pay to go to university? $20,000, $30,000, $60,000, $100,000. Why? Because you trust the system, right? So you do it. You go through 3 years, 4 years, 5 years, 6 years, 7 years, 8 years, 9 years, 10 years. Yes? Why? Because you trust the system. But if you trusted bodhicitta and primordial wisdom, then you would also do that. But if you don't, why would you? It's pretty cool if you think about it. Oh, it's pretty cool. If you think about it. But if you're not thinking about it, it's not cool.
It's not cool.
It's not cool, it's not hot. So here's another thing to consider. We have six different sensations all day long. We have the sensation of seeing, right? Tell me if you have any more. We have the sensation of seeing, we have the sensation of touch, we have the sensation of hearing, of smell, of tasting. Am I missing anything? I think that's five. Okay? Those are the five primary senses. And we have one more, six. We have the sensations of the mind. Right now, can you bite into an apple? Try it. Mentally, bite into an apple. Crunch. Isn't that cool?
Yeah.
How about have some orange juice?
Taste. Yeah.
Isn't that something? Can you taste the orange juice?
Yeah.
So all mental states have sensation with them. Most of the time, we're actually visualizing something. We're very visual beings. All right? So what do we actually attach to? We attach to sensations all day long. We attach to the sensation, just like fuego going off. Wow, what was that? What don't we attach to? The continuum of experience, the gap. The gaps in between. We don't attach to that. It's boring. Why would we do that? We're sensation lovers, right? Fuego. How many people sit here and look at fuego when it's doing nothing? Wow, isn't that amazing? You know, there's no difference. Try this. I'll give you a really advanced meditation to do. There's no difference in experience between fuego blowing off steam, erupting, and fuego not erupting. The taste of the experience is the same. The phenomena is different by detail. Do you believe me?
Yes.
No.
I can see that. That's it. The sound of the honking is the same sound as this. It has the same nature. As long as we keep cataloging the differences, we don't look for the nature of all phenomena. We're catalogers. We're museum curators. Could you imagine curating the Uffizi Gallery in Firenze? Have you been there? Fantastic, eh? And you never ask yourself the question, what's the nature of art? You just keep putting up the art and moving it around. And this is one by Botticelli, this one is by Leonardo da Vinci, yes? And you got the names right. Right? You got the names right. It's all cataloged. But you never ask yourself, what's the nature, the global essence nature of art? This is what it is. So therefore, every time we have a phenomena, including self, it feels very real and solid, and we have to attribute a story or causality or something to it. When in fact, if we really look at it with a very insightful mind, we'll see it is as clear and ephemeral, just like looking at a rainbow. And if we keep on going, If we keep on going, we're going to find out that all of those sense experiences, including self, are the light of primordial wisdom, when it felt like a sensation. In fact, it's primordial wisdom just sending out light rays. Now we're into Dzogchen Mahamudra Bodhicitta. Yes.
I hope I don't embarrass myself here. Part of
there's part no real self to embarrass.
Okay, good. sometimes I do watch Weibo when it's not doing anything, but I also encounter a sense of anticipation, or and I can't decide if it's hopefulness or fear of missing out, which is a generational thing. And how do I push back on that so that I'm just watching the nothing?
You don't want to push back.
No.
And you don't want to reside in nothing. There's nothing to reside in. There's no nothing to reside in. Being at ease in the experience of mind is the key. Not the phenomena. Which one is more interesting to you?
Mm-hmm.
You're looking at the object, look at the mind. Look at the nature of the experience reflecting the object in your mind. They're the same. Not even a shred of difference. It has the same taste in the mind. Which one is more interesting to the mind? The new sensation, the unusual sensation, is more interesting, but they still have the same nature. Mind. What's the mind really like? That's the question. Then you can remain in equanimity, looking at fuego blowing or not blowing, and there's no anticipation. Why? Because the mind's resting in the experience of mind. Let me give you a metaphor, which is one of the most powerful meditative metaphors. A mirror can reflect anything, isn't that true? Right? Mm-hmm. Does a mirror discriminate which is more important, fuego blowing or fuego at peace? Are you getting this?
Yes.
But look at the quality of the mirror. Isn't it magnificent? The quality of the mirror. Have you ever looked at a mirror and you're just absolutely fascinated by a mirror? It's stainless, it reflects everything, it holds nothing. Isn't that right? Does a mirror ever grasp the object that passes into it? It doesn't, does it? A mirror reflects everything without any attachment. And yet everything in the mirror is resplendent and luminous light. That's exactly the way our minds are. And yet it feels solid and real, like it's held there, but it's not. That's called mirror-like wisdom. In Tantra, it's called mirror-like wisdom. If you meditate on the mind like a mirror and come to that experience, nothing sticks. But it doesn't mean that you can't enjoy, and it doesn't mean that you can't enjoy when fuego blows and take pictures. But you know the nature of experience and aren't caught into it. It's a phenomenal arising that doesn't have stickiness. You see? And the sign that's actually occurring, there's some realization, there's some experience, is that when there is a afflictive state, it rises but falls very quickly. And the degree to which there are stories made up in the day, no, let me rephrase that, because the grammar is terrible. I can already tell. The degree to which one makes up stories and follows stories is the degree to which one is caught in them. As one progresses in liberation, one makes up less and less stories. Right? Less and less stories. And when a story is created about anything, a fantasy, an idea, it actually falls. It just dissolves faster and faster and faster. Just, it has no energy behind it. Okay? Now, if you're telling a story for good purpose, good. But these incessant stories, which are self-referencing stories, which are really infusions of neurohormones into the bloodstream to keep us pumped up, when they fall, the mind can rest in a state of equanimity that doesn't actually have to have a story about anything. It can rest. That's different than calm. That's different than tranquility. Tranquility is an effort to be tranquil. This is abiding in the natural awareness of the mirror-like wisdom of the mind. You're getting, this is an introduction to your mind's nature. You're receiving an introduction to mind's nature. If you can meditate on that, you'll have extraordinary progress. But you have to have enough other qualities. So you don't need to do anything at all. That's the problem. You don't need to do anything. Even in the end, we have to stop meditating. Meditation is an effort to get a state. In the end, at an advanced state, we actually stop meditating. A teacher will tell you, don't meditate anymore. What should I do? Do nothing at all, but just let your mind reside in its natural state. That is the meditation. So all meditation is training to do what? Abide in the natural state, which is an expansiveness of compassion, luminous clarity, and utterly free of any afflictive states. Okay? One more, yes.
Okay, I liked your analogy about the fellow person with their hand in the ground.
Oh, okay.
Okay, and people are coming along and feeding this person and so on. And to them, that's normal, you know. But if they ever discover somehow they discover, and we're talking through the practice, that they can actually take their hand out of the ground and realize what they're capable of doing, and literally the perception of themselves and everything around them changes almost seemingly on a cellular level, body, mind, and soul. The question is, and the freedom that brings is indescribable. Could they ever put their hand back in the ground again?
Yes. Out of compassion. Liberation is not leaving people. Liberation is being able to enter into the confusion and suffering of beings, know its nature, and help from within. So once we know how to remove our hand out of the stuckness, we can put it back in for the help and compassion of other beings. You're not afraid. The states aren't fearful anymore. Being states aren't fearful, you can enter into them and you know that they're actually empty of any intrinsic nature. If you feel how stuck one is, how many people have ever felt stuck?
Two hands.
You should. It is one of the best insight stages you come to in meditation, is feeling absolutely stuck. Just bound. Absolutely bound in karmic formations, bound in conditioning. It's a glorious state. It's very uncomfortable at the beginning, but once you start to see, you realize, oh my God, when I turn my head, it's conditioned. When I do this, it's conditioned. Right? And then you got to go, I'm going to actually see through this. All that conditioning is empty. But it takes someone to come along and tell you it's empty. It's empty of any binding. There is attachment, but there's no attachment. There's no one attaching. And here's why we don't like to remove our hand from the hole, our arm from the hole. Because as all of you know, when you do start to pull the arm out, it's very disconcerting and it's very unpleasant and it feels really weird. Therefore, we want to stay in the comfort zone. Isn't that right? We don't want to get out of our comfort zone. If I said to you, one of the best ways to make gluten-free pancakes is to add psyllium husk powder to it. You'd go, no, I'm going to do it the way I've always done it. Why? It feels more comfortable. But when someone comes along and says, this is something new, something you could do, for a lot of us, our default position is to stay in the comfort zone even though it is painful. But we get used to it and we don't know it's bound. It's really just see life. So we have to unbind. We have to unbind. And often when we unbind, we come up to unbinding, we're very nervous, we're very agitated. It's one of the great signs in meditation retreats is when a student says, I'm absolutely agitated. I absolutely don't want to go there. I don't even want to meditate anymore. And you know the person's right up at the edge of freedom, of a new freedom, because the system doesn't want to let go. The bodhicitta wants to let go. The wisdom mind knows it wants to let go. But the organism is fearful from the stability, even if it's utterly painful, even if it's utterly harmful. I want to keep robbing banks. It makes me really comfortable. I love going to jail. I love being arrested. I love when they put the cuffs on. You know, this kind of thing. And actually, for some people, it's that weird. Why do you do that? Because, well, I know. But to introduce someone to absolute, utter freedom of the mind, right, can be actually disturbing. You have to be in the right place to listen to it and go, oh my gosh, that is glory. That's glory. And even see, so there's a prayer in Dharma, which is praying for those who've never experienced bodhicitta for it to ripen. And for those that have experienced bodhicitta, for it to keep ripening. Because what happens is we get into our comfort zone and we don't want to go further. And yet we have to keep going further until we bind. So the definition, there's actually a term for complete total liberation. The term in translated into English for complete total liberation is called the collapse of all phenomenal experience. All views, all stories, all make-believe, all fabricated states actually collapse like the ocean into a completely clear ocean or a sky that's absolutely free of cloud cover. And then you can bring back the clouds. Okay, I think we'll take a pause there. One more? Yes?
One more question, but you don't, I would prefer you answer it this afternoon anyway, but I want to get the question. Many of us can't attend retreats regularly. We can't live in a monastery because of maybe other responsibilities. Could you recommend some daily practices that we could address or follow to help us grow in this, and evolve further? And maybe you could address that in the afternoon.
I could do that right now. Is the practice of loving kindness and compassion just gave? If one practiced that all day long in working life, daily life, it's absolutely fantastic. I've done both my life. I made a decision to the chagrin and irritation of His Holiness the 16th Karmapa not to stay as a monk for my life, and said to him, if I'm going to teach, which I was asked to teach, Dharma at an early age, if I'm going to teach, I actually need to know what this working life and relationships are like, and be able to do it that way, life of a yogin. People have this idea that one needs to have formal sessions. Yes, you do. But one actually really needs to develop the art of being able to contemplate all day long, whether we're working, whether we're at home, we're taking care of children, so it's unbroken. So loving kindness practice can be done, the practice I gave yesterday and the compassion practice, they can be done all day long, but it takes real concentration, determination to do that while you're in a meeting. So when I was at work, different kinds of work, what I would do is I had a job once where I was in meetings all day long. Pretty much from about 8 o'clock in the morning till 9 o'clock at night. And what I would do is I would take pauses between meetings, and I would sit in front of my laptop in my office. My office had glass windows around it. And I would just go like this, pretend that I was working on my computer, but I would take 5 minutes or 10 minutes between meetings, and I would simply do this. And people would say to me, say, you look very still when you're working on your computer. It's almost like you're doing nothing. And in fact, that's exactly, I was letting the mind rest, and I was entering into the contemplation of whatever the theme was for that day or that month. For one job, for a while, it was Vajrasattva, the purification of all sentient beings, the utter stainless nature. So I would enter into that quality, and then I go into the meeting with that quality. So not only would I do the work that I needed to do, but actually behind that was the intention of that particular meditation. So it can be done. And so every day becomes the retreat. Every day becomes the vihara, the monastery, the training ground. But I would say to all of you, not because I'm a Hoover vacuum cleaner salesman of retreats, but people think that, many people think they can't go on retreat, but one way they can is to begin to take weekends, take a whole weekend off, put away the phone, find a space that's pretty free of clutter and newspapers or magazines and computers, and actually take up a practice for the weekend. Start Friday night. I was introduced to this as a teenager where I lived. Friday night we'd go into retreat, and we'd come out Monday morning and go into university. Like straight out, right into university. Just walk right out, 20 hours a day. Walking, sitting, 20 hours a day. So you can take a day, you can take a weekend. And eventually you'll say, aha, I think I'd like to take a week. And eventually you'll see that for everybody I know, I mean, we've had retreats, 5-6 month retreats, where people said, that's impossible, who could ever do that? And I say, well, we've had people who are students, we've had people who are in business, we've had one or two independently wealthy, but most people actually find the time and the place when they're really interested to actually take time off of a month, of a week, of 2 weeks, 3 weeks, 3 months, whatever it is, to actually engage in the study of the awakened mind. But I would say we can start right now. Yeah. So all these practices I'm giving you, you can actually practice them right now. This is the art. Unbroken. No breaks between your meditation session. When you get up, you're still doing it. This is the art. Does that help? Loving kindness. Practice loving kindness for 3 months, 6 months. So it's like giant, fantastic practice. There, Namgyal Rinpoche told of a man in Burma when he was there in the 50s. His sole practice was loving kindness. People would come all over Burma to just to have sight of him. Everybody, you know, the practitioners knew he was an enlightened being. But he had done nothing for about 30 years, but all day long practiced loving kindness until he was a ball of love. And Namgyal Rinpoche said, people just wanted to go and touch him. So it's like, please, and get blessings and anything, just to be in his presence. The man was just this radiant, utterly, he had practiced for 30 years love. But he wasn't awakened. He didn't know his mind's nature, but he just emanated love. And people just wanted to be with him. Yeah. Practice loving kindness, but also practice the awake mind. Okay, let's take a 10-minute break, and we'll come back and enter into what's coming next.
Thank you.
Yeah.
mind the way it is. Some hot water would be great. I think Roberto is missing today.
Yeah, he left.
Yeah,
he said he could
have.
Yeah,
he had
to stay.
Oh, okay. Lovely to see. Maybe we can just...
Would you throw this, Rob?
Yeah, the plant.
This isn't very hot either.
I'll
can we get
more.
Some more?
Yeah.
Okay. Lovely class.
I think this is warm. Oh, no.
Let's
try this one. Anyway, I'm going to call it.
That's slightly warm, but... Maybe
yeah,
fill up another one. That's kind of cool. Maybe one should have
the four or something. That's a lovely ring.
I know, some of the special
favorites. Really.
You
want to go out and see?
I'll take you.
Fine. I've given out how many meditations now?
I don't know. A bunch. Like I said, I have something specific.
Well, they had loving kindness yesterday. Now they're going to have Taro.
Might tell them to try to do it twice a day, like, 30 minutes a day or something like that. Something specific because they don't get it otherwise.
It's really something.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, you told Namjo Rinpoche this, and I'm going to keep telling you this too, is you have to be more specific. Because just giving out something like that, I mean, it's totally obvious for a lot of us, totally obvious to you, but it isn't to people. They don't understand that they can do that all day long, nor can they, but they can practice 30 minutes. But I love the idea of, you know, taking classes too throughout the day. That's really been helpful. I think it's really helpful. Take, you know, just 5 minutes, regroup. Anyway, lovely class, great. Well, maybe, seeing Danielle's here, I might ask him if he would take a couple of pictures from the back.
Oh, sure.
He's okay for that. Look at them all. There's still a lot of people here. But I think there's a few less. So Robert left.
Yeah, he's busy with his,
yeah,
his duties.
I think that might be the man. Yeah.
Cynthia.
Hello.
Cynthia.
I think I've resolved the pump going on. The back bathroom was... You know, the toilet was running, and that's what makes the pump go on. And so that was that noise you were hearing? Or you might not have been aware of it, but the pump was coming on and off. But I think I've resolved it. So.
I have noticed it, but don't mind it.
Thank you. This is wonderful. Thank you so much.
Dharma is wonderful. Not this being, but Dharma is so liberating.
It is, isn't it?
It is.
That's great. That's nice that you could host this, Cynthia. Thank you.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Lovely.
Completely. This is wonderful.
This is actually really comfortable with this. I must say, really.
He's happy to keep.
I just sit
bed.
Here for hours.
He likes that seat that I brought.
Oh, great.
So I think we found a winner here. winning competition. You look very comfortable.
Yeah,
we'll have this house for many years, so we can do this. Many times.
So you're going to try to fix the sun?
Yes, what we're going to do is I've asked Misha to stay, and we're going to keep in a sheet
over
that last part there.
And what about this part?
Do you think there should be a sheet
down
here too?
Oh gosh, yes.
Okay, we can do a sheet all the way along easily enough.
Yeah, because this part over here, we were...
Do you want some nice fabrics? Do you have some nice fabrics that you could put over?
Well, we have a lot of Typica fabrics. The thing is that I was thinking that sheets would be lightweight, and if we put them on the outside of the curtains, they wouldn't look so ugly. But it would cut the light for sure.
Very good.
Yeah,
okay.
I think sheets are probably the right way to do it too, because they're right with.
Yeah, and if they fall off, it's not the end of the world or anything. Most of the Typica is so heavy that it hangs differently.
Yeah. Well, Well, good luck with that. Yeah, I have to say, it was, I was okay. I could tell people were suffering. I just closed my eyes. So it was really bright.
And she was very backwards.
We're completely in the sun.
Yes.
I saw them.
I put a few of them in because, Tom Jacobson, he's just been diagnosed with melanoma, so he's been treated. And so when he came back after lunch, I said, your dermatologist and myself want you to sit in the shade. And he looked at me because, yeah, my dermatologist would probably be very upset if I were sitting in the shade.
Yeah, you're kidding.
Yes. 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 So he's dealing with that one. But they think they got it early and they got it off. So
good.
That's good.
Good.
So yes, we will have light coming in through the sheet because that is light enough. But we will not have the sunlight.
I got the invitation.
I just wanted to say hello.
Hello.
And sorry,
hello, sir.
Sorry not to have been here yesterday, but there are some heavy things going on in our couplehood right now. Maria Elena's dad just died.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Oh, she just died?
Oh, Friday.
Friday.
Yeah. So.
Timely or untimely?
It was his time. It was his time.
Good then.
But nonetheless.
Nonetheless,
these
difficult.
Things cause.
Yeah.
A lot of things. So, but anyway,
what's his name?
Adrian.
His name is Adrian.
Mm-hmm.
Well, may he pass through very well.
Yeah. It was. Those things happen.
Maybe they have to happen.
Yeah. Okay, I'll let you answer it.
Hello. I wanted to say, hey, and I like your hair.
Oh, okay.
You know, I don't know why that's come out, but it's kind of like, it's more,
like
it's more
too.
Au naturel.
I'm sorry to hear about your father-in-law. Yeah. My condolences to Maria Elena.
Yeah.
I sent her a little note.
And that's probably why Maria Elena's not here.
Yeah.
Still. It's just
absolutely.
Not a moment for her.
Of course.
Yeah.
Of course. I'm sorry to hear that.
Anyway, we're all doing that.
Yeah, please give her our condolences.
Yeah.
I will.
It was tough.
Danielle, I have a request. Would you take the photographer is here. Could you get a photo of him or kind of in the back? Would it be possible to just
do it this afternoon?
Yeah. Yeah.
Because I don't have my camera with me,
okay.
But I could do that this afternoon.
I'd
rather do it with my camera if you can wait.
Right.
I'll be here in the afternoon.
Okay. It's kind of blazingly light here in the afternoon. Is that good?
Well, at the early.
We will have sheets.
We will have that.
Okay.
Actually,
okay.
The light, when she puts that down, the light should actually be interesting.
Okay. It should be. But it would be nice if you could get a photo for us. That would be lovely. Thank
very
you.
Very pleased. It's the least.
Laurel took pictures yesterday, and I was making funny faces.
He was. I've never actually seen such a bad photo of you. It was so bad. I seemed to time it just right.
Well, it's hard to time it with a cell phone.
Yeah.
That is the problem with those.
Yeah, and I was at a bad angle. I'm looking up here, so it's better to have something over the back. Okay,
back into the
sun. Sure, you don't want to go warm up just for 5 minutes? We'll just go. I'll walk up you over there. Are you sure?
I stay here for hours.
Yeah, I know, but it might be good for you to get a little sun.
Tomorrow. Beach.
Do we need to put air box or anything?
No,
still okay.
Still okay.
Well, you're not coughing anyway. Like
it's just
yesterday.
In this.
Windy, huh? No, Deborah.
Gracias.
No, Cynthia.
Yes, I met her.
Gracias. Okay.
Can you try it if you're
sure.
Too warm? Or
oh, perfect.
Yeah? Should I be cool somewhere?
Sure.
Next week, if you have time for an interview.
Yep. And I'd like to give the reading transmission for this next week.
Okay.
Okay. Yeah, we can do that.
How is your?
It's just, you know, I get this every time I come to Guatemala. It seems to be good. So I see that. We'll go to the beach and see if that.
Oh, how are you going?
To the beach tomorrow. Oh, see if it's there.
Yeah.
But every time. It's something that lives in me. It likes to come out.
And here.
That's because you're doing those practices in the same way. When I do it, I become meditative. That's exactly right.
I thought I was, but I just.
That's spontaneous. Because that's they're training at a higher level. As a Yadam, not as yourself.
Yeah, so I need to just.
That's right. Very good. Exactly right. Exactly right.
If we were in Wisconsin, we'd be a football game.
Did you bring a Drikhon prayer book?
I took it out.
See, yeah.
Maybe Cynthia has one.
Yeah, Cynthia has.
Me too.
Anybody else in that?
Is a coffee coming?
Yeah, Cynthia is bringing
it. So while we're waiting, I'm just waiting for a text that I thought was in my bag, but not. In following up to, I'm sorry, your name?
Vincent.
In continuing in Vincent's question there, one of the best things I've found to do during the day.
Thank you.
Is not only a morning meditation, when you get up in the morning, either before breakfast or after breakfast, a formal session of loving kindness, a formal session of compassion, a formal session of Tonglen, whatever it's going to be. But throughout the day, this is a strong recommendation, learn to take many pauses. Just stop. It's very hard for people to do today. Just completely stop. And if you can't do it at your office or your workplace because people will watch you and you're going like this, then go to a toilet somewhere to close the door and just pretend that you're on the throne. And so it's a matter of stopping and letting everything settle. Whether you practice a formal meditation or not, but coming to rest, not sleepy rest, not, dreamy rest, but a very vivid, energetic rest. Sitting, standing, doesn't matter. You can just find a corner somewhere and just stand with your eyes open and just let everything settle out for 5 minutes, 2 minutes, 10 minutes, whatever it is. And then pursue the activities again and try to bring that quality into everything you do. And this, I think, is really, really important, especially today where people aren't pausing anymore. I see people just don't pause. They don't stop. One of the reasons for doing retreats is not just to be on retreat, is to have a period of training like going to school, where then when you come back into daily life, you have the discipline and training of practices that you know well, and they come up like this, just like that. They're just there because you've done so many hours, like playing a musical instrument, you just pick up the musical instrument, you can hit the note just right. So that's also why we do retreats, so that the daily life experience is imbued with that background and that support. Really, really helps. Really helps a lot. So you've received a number of practices. Actually, I think I've given out about 6 or 7 or 8 practices so far. The two main ones, being loving kindness and compassion. Those are both very high practices. Before I start into Tonglen, I might not get to it until this afternoon, but I want to give the background so we can practice Tonglen. It's a very, very famous meditation. Is the nature of refuge, because we're going to say refuge. In the text I handed out, it says that we don't know where to look for freedom. So we attach to things that may or may not work. Most of what we're doing is we're attaching to some state in which we're free of anxiety or afflictive states. In the teaching of Dharma, the distillation of what to focus on is 3 things. What's called the Buddha, the Dharma, the Sangha. And it's not so much about the historic Buddha that we actually take refuge in, is that when we're tossed about in a very rough sea, anybody been on a ship in really difficult weather? What do we usually do? We seek refuge. Where do we seek refuge? Either on our bed or we go up to the bridge, yes? The best place is the bridge usually. When we're tossed about in a stormy sea of afflictive states, we always seek out a refuge. We seek out a refuge in our self-referencing. We seek out a refuge in our loved ones. We seek out a refuge in our education. We seek out a refuge on the internet. We seek out refuge in Amazon.com or Facebook. And we're always seeking out refuges out of a turbulent or difficult state. Is that right?
Yeah.
But in the teaching of Dharma, the refuge that we actually go for is what actually works, which is refuge in Buddha nature. It's easy. refuge in Buddha nature, refuge in the teachings that liberate, and refuge in a community of beings that actually have some experience in liberation. Those are called the three refuges or the three jewels. So when we practice Tonglen, we not only generate bodhicitta, but we also take refuge, remind ourselves how we can come out of the storm. So I want to mention that. So part of the discovery of Dharma is what works. This is something we have to find for ourselves. This takes a while. So when we go on page 10, I'm going to go through this first step by step, so we know what we're actually practicing. So the first thing we do is we generate bodhicitta, this enlightenment mind, this pristine awareness, this enlightenment mind, this unbounded compassion for all sentient beings to attain this total freedom. And then we take refuge, and then we take up the four common foundations. As this excellent body of mind with leisure and endowments will be difficult to obtain repeatedly in the future, right now will accomplish the state of unsurpassed Samantabhadra. Now, this is from a particular text. This is basically a contemplation that you never know in life when one's leisure and endowments will be snatched away. That's called death and illness or misfortune. Never know. God forbid, we never know here in Guatemala or anywhere in the world, in many places where there could be a natural disaster. All gone. Yeah. Recently in California? Yes? I think all of us are aware of that. I have a house on Galliano Island in a major earthquake zone. Could be gone. Torrential rain, illness, anything. Could even be a major flu epidemic. It could be a financial meltdown, and we actually don't have any income at all. This can happen. So right now we have a body, we have a relative good health, and we have a leisure. And it can be very, very difficult to have in the future or in future rebirths. So it's important to get on with accomplishing the state of Samantabhadra, which is total awakening, to meaningfully benefit others. That's very profound. What is meaningfully benefiting others? And this is a precious human body. It turns out, from the perspective of Dharma, the history of Dharma, the human body is an ideal body for awakening because it suffers. It not only experiences godlike states, but it experiences every kind of state. And because of that, even hell-like states. Yeah? All of you had hell-like states? Yeah. Awful. God-like states?
Yeah. Much better.
And everything in between?
Yeah.
And it can fluctuate all day long?
Yeah.
Yeah? Okay, because of that ability, the human being is said to have ideal conditions for liberation. It doesn't, it's not so godlike that we go all day long for years. And so hell-like that we can't even get out of the hell. So we're in between. We fluctuate. Next, I and other beings are impermanent. The time of death being uncertain. We simply don't know what's going to happen next. We think we do. We feel like we know what's going to happen next. What are you going to do after this? Probably have lunch? Yes? And there'll be a class this afternoon? We have no certainty of that. We don't know if we're going to wake up tomorrow. We don't know what's going to be like, right? And some of you in the room know that, yes? Because of illnesses? Not knowing if you're even going to make it for the next day. So life is absolutely impermanent. But we have an emotional feeling of a continuance that is all going to be fine tomorrow. but not necessarily. And life can be very short. Since there is no opportunity for ultimate happiness, the word happiness there means supreme happiness of liberation. Since there is no opportunity for happiness wherever one is born in samsara, samsara means wandering in endless rebirths, or in this lifetime, wandering from state to state. And since a happy existence was never seen, that is a truly happy existence, was never seen, I'll enter the path of nirvana, that is freedom, total freedom. In order for this body with leisure and wealth to possess meaning, I'll abandon the three non-virtuous poison afflictions of greed, hatred, delusion, develop diligence in virtuous actions and ethical actions, and protect the vows and commitments of body, speech, and mind. So these are the preliminaries we do for this practice. And it's better to go through this now instead of just repeating it. Now, some of you do not practice Guru Yoga, and some of you do not have a spiritual, a physical, living spiritual teacher, mentor. So if you don't have that, then you can place a Buddha figure, something that represents a complete liberation, above your head. So the next section says, your root guru, that is the being that gave you the liberating instructions and brought you to recognize your mind's nature, or gives empowerment, sits on a lotus moon seat above your head. His body is radiant, his face is happy and smiling as regards all beings with non-referential compassion. So if you don't have a teacher like that, it's actually traditional to visualize it as a Buddha figure. It could be Manjusri, it could be Shakyamuni Buddha, it could be Chenrezig. But somebody that something that represents total liberation. In him, all the root and lineage teachers are present with intense respect and devotion. Repeat the lineage prayer if you wish, and in particular, the following prayer 100 or 1,000 times. We usually repeat it a lot shorter than that, depends on your session. And this is making contact with the teaching, the lineage, and the feeling that you've actually receiving transmissions and blessings. And this is one way of saying it. I pray for your blessing, my guru, great and completely worthy spiritual friend. I pray that you will cause love, compassion, and bodhicitta to arise in my mind. You know, one of the things about a spiritual friend, a teacher, is the difference between a teacher and a spiritual friend, or sorry, a friend and a spiritual friend, is that your friend will not necessarily tell you what you don't want to hear. Whereas a spiritual teacher often tells you things that you've never heard, or things you didn't really want to hear, but you realize later, thank goodness they said them. So when you see someone like the Dalai Lama giving a talk and recalling his teachers and how his teachers taught him, I've seen this with my own eyes, in the middle of 20,000 people just sitting in front of him, and the tears are streaming down his face and going, if it wasn't for them, I wouldn't be the way I am. Because teachers... if they're Dharma teachers or spiritual teachers, they will help you see what you don't want to see. Not because they're nasty, but out of compassion and love. Our friends often don't do that for us. See? So that is why the spiritual teacher, spiritual friend, is of such importance to be able to deliver from a living human being that which we simply can't see and we don't want to hear, or we're blind to. And that is very, very precious. Then imagine that your guru or your lama descends through the aperture of Brahma, through the channel here, the subtle energy channel on the crown, and sits in your heart in a pavilion of light like an open shell. So it's important to understand what this teacher represents. The teacher doesn't represent, this being here, which has the title Lama, or spiritual teacher, is called the outer manifestation. I'm an outer manifestation. But we take up this outer manifestation to come to see the inner nature of ourselves. Do you follow? The guru isn't something outside ourselves. They're actually of our mind's nature. This is very important. So we place that Buddha figure, that liberative symbol, in our heart, in a pavilion of light, and it's very beautiful. Think of a clamshell, or a lotus like this, and the figure is sitting in radiance, in a ball of light, in a sphere of light, in the heart, and this light is a beautiful feeling of composure, of insight, of blessings, and it radiates from our heart. So this is where we start. And then we count the breath to 21 times. And this is a tranquility meditation. So we sit in a good posture, and we count the breaths coming in. So one, in. And bring the breath from the tip of the nose all the way into the belly. Don't force it, though. Just follow it by sensation. Natural, no holding. Let the breath come out. Follow it. And that's done 21 times. If the breath comes down and settles, you will feel a deeper a tranquility. It takes time. So 21 times, and you're focusing on the sensation of the breath and trying not to be distracted. So we do that 21 times. And then we have what's called vipassana, or insight, with a support. We regard all phenomena, all experience, inner and outer, as dreamlike. So this is where we come to the, we start with the wisdom nature, and with our eyes open, everything that we experience has this transparent quality. Eventually you'll come to that, and people will have a transparent quality, rooms will have a transparent quality, everything will have an openness to it, because experience is actually open. Isn't that funny? Look at the wall. See the wall? Doesn't look solid? But if you look at the wall and you look at experience at the same time, you will see that the wall has no substantiality. Isn't that cool? When you have a dream, how many people have dreams? Hey, all recall dreams? Are the dreams solid or unreal? When you're having the dream, they feel very solid, yes? And very real. When you wake up out of it, you know that the dream is just an imagination, yes? Were you inside or outside of the dream?
Inside.
Inside. The dream is arising from the mind, yes? What's it like right now? Is the experience arising from the outside or the inside?
Inside.
Where is it happening?
Inside.
Do you see? Where is it happening? What have you been told? It's happening out there. Where is it happening? Where is the experience happening?
Inside.
In your mind. Do you follow? Same thing. Dreams, daily dreams, sleepy dreams, daydreaming, all the same phenomena. Now, insight, wisdom without support. Examine the nature of unborn awareness. So however you do it, you try to actually see through the phenomena and let the mind rest in this unborn, it's uncreated, unfabricated state of infinite compassion. The next one, even the remedy antidote is free to subside naturally. Let itself liberate. Let me give you the instruction. I gave it yesterday, but I'll give it to you again. Do you need to untie a snake that is coiled in a knot? Yes or no? Let's see a show of hands.
Yes.
I like teaching like this. Let's see a show of hands. Do you need, out of compassion, to untie the snake that is in a knot?
No.
Let's see a show of hands.
No.
Okay. Do you need to untie emotional afflictions?
Yes.
Will they untie or stay bound? Do you see? You need to do nothing. The more you do nothing, the faster they will uncoil. The more you do something, the more it will stick. This is getting rid of the antidote. You need to do nothing. Look at whatever state arises and let the snake uncoil.
Yeah.
Don't need a story. It will uncoil. The less there is a story, the faster it will uncoil. Just try to believe that. Please.
So is that the same as unbound?
Unbinding. Just let it unbind. Let it self-liberate. Don't try to liberate it. You don't have to liberate anything. It's all liberated. There never was a snake bound. So let me give you an example. Do you think the snake feels it's tied up in a knot?
No.
Do you think that your emotion feels like it's bound? You getting the idea? If a thief comes in to steal your silver jewelry or your silverware, and there's actually nothing of substantial nature in the house, you can just let the thief steal emptiness. This is the nature. So the key here, this is a very high teaching. This is a profound meditation. The key here is to relax vividly and let everything unbind naturally as it will unbind without any fabrication or trying, and you will eventually see that it will. That confidence is profound. Next one, rest in the nature of all, the basis of everything. Rest the mind in the natural state. Let the mind rest. Don't let it be sleepy. Let it just be awake, restful, and lucid. And if you have training in bodhicitta, it's going to rest lucid with compassion. Why? That's the way the mind is. Next one, relative bodhicitta. This is where, so you go from the absolute to the relative. Love and compassion to someone close, like your mother. Feel that feeling of how much love and compassion one has, or one's mentor, or someone that you know, and then eventually those that dislike you and those who you dislike. Then love and compassion to all sentient beings. Next one, train in taking and sending alternately. Now this I need to give some teaching on, or it's a bit dangerous. Is amazing practice. What you do here is, because you know that there's no substantial nature to your body experience, to your feelings, to your states, doesn't mean it's nothing. It has no substantialized difference. Like rainbow light. You breathe in all the negative afflictions of sentient beings or a certain person with the in-breath. And you bring it in, and you let that blackness, that darkness, come into your heart center, into the pavilion of light. And you let your teacher, or the Buddha, whatever it is, do all the work for you. Because it's the nature of emptiness, it can't harm you. And as you bring it into your heart center, which is a state of loving kindness, emptiness, openness, spaciousness, all that blackness disappears into rainbow light. It vanishes into rainbow light. And then what do? You breathe out what for beings?
Light.
All that rainbow light. You breathe out through your nostrils and you spread it for all sentient beings. You can even breathe it out. Eventually you'll feel it come out all your pores, not just your nostrils, but it will just radiate out through your pores. Okay, so you as long as you are practicing, it can be 21 times, you don't count, but this is the major part of the session, is you breathe in all afflictive states as emptiness, as black light emptiness. You dissolve it into the heart, into the figure in your heart. It turns into rainbow light, and you breathe it back out and you spread it. It's very, very beautiful. And that's why it's called Tonglen, taking and sending alternately. You're being the most generous person you can by taking on that which is emptiness, and you're sending back out luminous emptiness. Then you dedicate the merit, you dedicate the strength of the practice, and then in post-meditation practice, you're like a magician. You know, when you're a magician, you know it's a magical show, but you know how it's done. This is Dharma. When you're the spectator, you don't know how it's done, and it's pretty cool. But when you're a magician, you can have both fun and interest and joy because you actually know how it's done, and you're not subject to the trick. So it says, and a great teacher, Trungpa Rinpoche, used to translate that as be like a child of illusion. But the text actually says practice like a magician. It's a magical show. Why is it a magical show? Right? What could come out of the sleeve? Anything at all. And how could you change that? Have you ever had someone come up to you and go, blah, 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 you know, some anxious moment or something, and you just change the view, just change the picture, or give them a hug, or hold their hand? What happens? The whole thing can change, yes? Oh, yeah. It's a magical illusion. What does a magician know how to do? How does magic work? Change the view so the person can't see how it's being done. Yeah? It's all like that. So. Okay. We'll come back this afternoon too, but let's give a very short session of this. And because it's now 11:30, we're going to go through the full session this afternoon, but what I'd like to do now is count the breath 21 times, and then resting the mind in this unborn awareness, and letting the afflictive states, any state. By the way, happiness is a state. It's not an afflictive state. Happiness is a state. Sadness is a state. Joy is a state. We want to come to unborn happiness. Joy. And then compassion for all sentient beings, just for about 10 minutes. And then we're going to take the light in, the light out, and we'll dedicate merit. So, very short. So let's start by counting the breath 21 times. And from the feeling of the breath at the nostrils, if you can, feel the sensation without force, filling the belly, resting in the belly, and coming back out. Let's do that 21 times. And then with the eyes open, regarding all phenomena, all experience as dreamlike. That whatever states are arising, thought states, feelings, let them unbind in that dreamlike quality. Let them untie themselves. When unbound, naturally self-liberated, untied, let the mind rest in that quality. And from that quality of unbound, no fixation, a profound compassion for every single sentient being. Let's finish with just a little bit of breathing in the suffering, the empty suffering states of all sentient beings into our heart center, through our nostrils. And it dissolves away into the openness of the heart. And breathing out white or rainbow light as an offering, as a gift for all sentient beings. Okay, that's good. Let's share the merit. I think that's plenty for this morning, and this afternoon we're going to give some bit more teaching on that, and then we're going to do a really full session of Tonglen. By this strengthening activity, this punyakama, by this merit that we have gathered together, may it lead to the cessation of the suffering states, the asavas, the floods of all sentient beings. Idante punyakamang asavakyuang hotu, idante punyakamang asavakyuang hotu, idante punyakamang asavakyuang hotu. Sabbe sattva sukhantu, may all beings be well and happy. May all beings be established in a natural continuum of freedom. Unborn, naked, aware, fresh, spontaneous, as a glorious gift of compassion for all sentient beings. Sarmangalam, Sarmangalam, Sarmangalam.
Thank you.